tuned to Northern Community Radio 91.7 KAXE.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Power Radio in Northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. On the River is our volunteer-hosted mix of folk, rock, jazz, blues, and world music on KAXE 7 days a week. Trained community members choose the music every weekday at 1 and 7, plus Saturdays at 4 and Sundays at 1. Big thanks to our dedicated volunteers. Watermark Art Center's next Story Slam is Thursday, October 16th at Bemidji Brewing. Music begins at 6 with stories at 7. This month's theme is Scared Stupid. Stories should be 5 minutes or less. Find more information at watermarkartcenter.org. The Heartland Symphony Orchestra performs Sunday, October 12th at 2:30 at the Geechee Zibi for the Arts. Free will donations accepted at the door. Find more at heartlandsymphony.com.
Hi there, friends. I'm glad you're here to hear an hour of story and song. Today on Stay Human, we're featuring some of the stories told live at our Authentic Voice storytelling show. It was Saturday night at Clocko Brewing in Grand Rapids, and friends and neighbors got together to tell about how not to back up a trailer, how to pass for a local, how to get rid of an impossible roommate, and a range of other useful and inspiring tales. Our first teller today held the crowd spellbound with this, teacher and writer Susie Saxog-Loeffler.
She's going to be okay. At this point, she doesn't know what that means. She's 5. Everything's okay. She's surrounded by love. Her parents are proud of her, and her grandparents have convinced her that she is not only the smartest girl in the world, but also the most beautiful. She doesn't know fear. She might fall down, bloody her knee, she might bump her head, but somebody is always there to pick her up, to put a Band-Aid on. In fact, in that scary moment when you have to take the Band-Aid off, her mom has a poem for that, that she recites so that she doesn't even know that it's happening. It just comes off. She hasn't found peers that take the wind out of her sails. She hasn't had that second grade teacher. Society hasn't taken the joy out of things yet. She is surrounded by love. She is confident. She is sure that the world will love her. She's going to be okay. She's in love. She's 18. She's in love for the first time, and we're not talking, I hope I sit next to Jeff in social studies, or the other Jeff in German class. No, this is real. This is, we can't stand to be away from each other, and if we're next to each other, we're holding hands, and we're starting to think about futures together, but we're practical. We are practical. He is economically minded, which is why we never go out to dinner anywhere. And we can't go to college together. We're not grown up enough for that. We have to think about the future. So she plans to go to St. Paul, and he plans to go to Grand Forks. And she is practical, so she tries to preemptively break up with him. And then 24 hours later is begging him to take her back because it hurts in the center of her chest, and she is crying. And of course he does. So then it's long distance for them. But there aren't cell phones, and he is economically minded, so you do not call long distance. There is this wonderful thing called email now, but our computers are back in our room, so that is a once-a-day prospect at best. But then he sends the message that he's going to come visit her for the weekend. And she emails her mother, and she says, I'm going to call tonight, and I have to talk about something very important. And I said, Mom, she, she said, Mom, I think I need to get on birth control. And her mom said, "Well, I figured it was that or you were coming out." So he visits, and it's wonderful, and they're in love, and he's all she ever thinks about. And then she wakes up one morning, and it's gone. She's not in love anymore. The feeling is gone. Her chest is empty. Does it just do this? Does love just do this? Does it just disappear? That's horrible. How is she going to tell him? She's going to be okay. She'll fall in love again. She's 24. And her best friend said, "You need to find somebody older." So she found a man. She found a man, and they were able to talk about things they disagreed about. There was still that pain in the chest, because you can't be together all the time, especially if you're adult with adult responsibilities, and he lives an hour away, and he needs to work on that house, and he did not plan to meet you yet. He lived an hour away from her, which meant that it was long-distance call, because still no cell phones, and he was also economically minded. Apparently, she has a type. But she did have a long-distance phone card, so sometimes there were phone calls. Sometimes there were phone calls from the green room in the basement of the theater where she was performing, and she would cry, and she would say, "Why are we doing this? Why aren't we together all the time?" And luckily, he realized she was very smart. And he said, "Yes, let's be together forever." And she said, "Yes." She's going to be okay. She's in her 30s, and the children have come. And she has found out that there's a different kind of falling in love. And it's not in your chest. It's in your belly. The love is in your belly, even after they come out. Nobody tells you that. And nobody tells you that there are new aspects to love that you are not expecting. You are not expecting the worry. You are not expecting the guilt. You are not expecting that every moment of your day would be about keeping those little people safe and protecting them. And you were certainly not expecting that maybe the way to keep them safe and to protect them is to have them not with you for a little while. She's going to be okay. But it's present day. And she's almost at 50. And the world is on fire, sometimes literally. The world is on fire, and things are hard, and nobody's agreeing with each other, and love is not a cure. But love is still her North Star. Love is still her guiding light. And she knows that even in her little part of the world, she can change things for the better. Even when things seem to be falling apart in enormous and tiny ways. She will be okay. She just doesn't know how.
Thanks to Susie Saxog-Leffler. You can find more of her work at her weekly Substack column, Sounds for My Brain.
Trust yourself to do
Goldberg. It's my privilege each week to collect and share stories from my fellow humans. The storytellers featured on today's show all work together at a workshop from the American School of Storytelling. Lauren Nimi was the trainer and coach, and he gave us an exercise designed to make us think about the arc of our own lives and the stories within that arc. Up next from Ely, the writing outfitter, Scott Stoll.
If you don't mind, I'd like to ask for a little audience participation. Just a show of hands. There's not going to be any singing. How many people here own a boat? Holy crap. All right. Maybe, or how many here people don't own a boat? Okay. Are there any tourists among us? You are? Bathrooms are over there. If you live in a state like Minnesota, one of the most important life skills you can learn is to back up a trailer. You probably don't know this yet, so I'm going to tell you. The Minnesota Department of Education has recently certified trailer backup as part of all their driver's ed courses. They came upon this idea from a story they heard about a guy named Scott. I heard about this guy. Read an article. Backing up a trailer was second nature for Scott. And he learned it in high school when he worked at an RV dealership. As you might guess, the business sold quite a few campers and boats and their trailers to go with them. And as part of helping them be able to move one trailer from a place to the next in the sales yard, they had a small old farm tractor. Now, understand that this is a time period in Scott's life when, fast forward, in a Volkswagen Beetle was more his style. But that tractor, it taught him how to slow down, just sitting in that open air seat, and it encouraged him to experiment with backing up. It taught him the value of, it's okay to take a wrong turn once in a while. And you know what? If scratch and dents happen, just make up a story about it. Scott has also witnessed the dark underbelly of ineptitude. He tells the story of a guy who he saw at a boat landing who had severely serpentined his boat and his trailer down the ramp right next to the dock. As far as Scott was concerned, the guy also accelerated at just arrogant speed. Well, when Scott saw this, he knew right away what happened. The guy had obviously lost sight of the trailer and the boat in his right rearview mirror. It had gotten hidden behind his truck bed. So, had the driver looked out his left rearview mirror, he would have seen that his boat trailer tire on the left side had started to go up onto the dock. For whatever reason, the guy stayed focused on the right-hand side. And as that trailer backed up, the distance between the dock and the water started to increase. And for every inch he backed up, that trailer with the boat on it started to tilt. Pretty soon, it wasn't long before that trailer flipped that boat into the lake like a burger. In the moments that the boat floated upside down, with the motor shaft and the propeller pointing skyward, it kind of looked like it was giving the guy the finger. Stories in general for Scott, they've been a big part of his life because he liked to do too much. And stories offered such an array of outlets from which to be told. So Scott did some exploring. and exploring takes time. In educational circles, there's a term for that. It's called psychosocial moratorium. And basically what it means is putting adulthood on hold. A person will take a period of time and they'll go out and just explore life, experiment with this or that. And eventually, this is all before then that they commit to a specific vocation. So Scott did some exploring. He made the rounds in mass media. He had been a television news photographer. He was a magazine and a newspaper editor. He was a radio copywriter, and he was a DJ for a while. He even tried acting and auditioned once for a movie. He didn't get the part, but the guy who did eventually made a big star of himself. But Scott didn't care. What Scott had begun to realize is that his actor's job is to pretend to be somebody else, whereas a writer's job is to get people to think. So Scott took a shot at being an English teacher in high schools, hoping to cultivate a love of literary arts for young people. And maybe that would have been a good calling for him. But after 10 years, the shoe just didn't fit anymore. He found that he'd rather be the writer than the writing teacher. And at that point, his psychosocial moratorium finally came to an end. All those syllables didn't go to waste. Today, and since then, Scott has gone beyond the halfway point in his life, but he still isn't afraid to back up. It's a backup more, though, like you back up to get a running start. And he still has his love of stories. And today, he drives shuttles for a canoe outfitter. And he transports paddlers to wilderness entry points. Along the way, they travel together. They trundle on down those gravel roads and they swap stories. And when they reach their destination, Scott backs up a trailer and they unload their gear. But once the paddlers have departed, solitude accompanies him on his way back. And it's during that quiet time that those new stories of his start to percolate. Thank you.
Thanks to Scott Stoll. Last year, Scott published a terrific collection of his stories and essays, Backroad Grace. You can find that and more of his work at his website, writingoutfitter.com. Thank you. Up next, Minneapolis-based Christine Mounts. She is used to performing her poetry at venues around the Twin Cities, but her appearance at our recent live storytelling show was an expansion for her into telling personal stories. Christine Mounts.
So it's the end of my sophomore year in college. I'm studying English at the University of Iowa, and I'm living in the dorm room with two other women. And at the end of your sophomore year, you're given an option not to have to live in the dormitory anymore, and thank God, because who the hell wants to do that? And we were discussing what it is we were going to do. My roommate, Aria, was going back to Kentucky. She would never return again, never see her again. But my roommate, Kathy, who only lived 40 miles away from Iowa City, decided to stay there to rent an apartment, to stay near work, and to not have to go home. And I thought that sounded like a really great idea, because I really didn't want to go home either. It wasn't that I wasn't welcome, it's just there wasn't much of a home to return to. And I was ready at that age to launch, to live my life, but I had no apartment or roommate. Kathy had a friend from high school that had attended the university with us, and we sort of coalesced as a friend group with her and some other girls. And she, finding out that Kathy was going to get an apartment, said, yeah, okay, yeah, I want to get an apartment too. And I thought, hey, ready-made roommate, okay. So we look for an apartment, and we find one on Fairchild Street. It's a second floor, two-bedroom apartment with an avocado 1970s kitchen. The two bedrooms weren't the same size. There was one larger, and I was fine with Lisa taking that because her boyfriend was coming down from Ames, Iowa to spend the summer with her. And I also didn't mind because my bedroom had a very large window that overlooked the city park, and it was just gorgeous. And the city without all the students is an incredible place to be. Blue skies, endless summer. We had this wonderful back set of stairs that you could sit out there and smoke cigarettes and listen to the neighbor that was a few houses down picking his banjo, playing songs all summer. And you could actually call out and request songs. And we'd say, play Heartbreak Hotel! And then you'd hear Heartbreak Hotel coming on the banjo. Roy was quite a romantic. He would wander town with her with a piece of chalk, and he'd write, I love Lisa, everywhere. And he was very proud of his very blue hair, and that he would catch me on occasion with a load, one of those explosive loads that you'd put in cigarettes and it'd blow up the cigarette. I'm like, Roy, what the heck? What are you doing? But he was very much in love with Lisa. But Lisa was not yet so interested in being married. She was interested in male attention. She was interested in visiting a buffet of sexual experiences. And she broke his heart. You know, by the end of summer, he was sleeping about 22 hours a day. And I was like, I was working all the time. So I was like, whatever. But he left at the end of summer. And Lisa kept her vibrator on her dresser like a bowling trophy. It's like, whatever. You're at that age, 19 years old, whatever. Things started to go south after Roy left. Lisa was not the best housekeeper. I'm not the best housekeeper either, but Lisa was really not a great housekeeper. And she would make a lot of dirty dishes and never wash them. She had a cat that she wouldn't clean its cat box, and the apartment started to smell like cat box, and she even had left a glass of milk on her nightstand that had been left there for so long it curdled and molded and became cheese, really. And so I couldn't really live like this, and so I would wash the dishes, whether they were my dishes or not. And she said to me, and I quote, oh, now I know how to get you to wash the dishes. I just don't do them, and you'll do them. Like, okay, lady. Lisa was not a person who had a defined sense of self. And it's normal for young people to, you know, you get in a group of friends and you want to be part of the group. You want to be part of the scene. And so she would take on the persona of whoever she was around. So she started obsessing over bands I was obsessed with, who she had never heard of, and buying their t-shirts and getting their records and getting tickets. And she was interested in the jobs I was applying to, and so she would apply the same jobs that I was applying to. And she was certainly interested in the men that other people were dating and was interested in getting to know them better. And so she's very competitive and also not very well defined. And this very much started to grate on my nerves. I'm like, lady, figure out who you are and not, you're not me. And I would go to Kathy's house, which was just three blocks up, and she lived there with her sister, who was attending community college in Iowa City. And I would complain about this particular aspect about Lisa. And her sister said to me, oh, you mean Leecha? And I was like, what? It's like, that's a nickname that this girl Lisa earned in high school, was Leecha, because this was her personality. And so Leecha continued until we reached a breaking point when I was like, I don't think I can do this anymore. She had, my friend Kathy took on a job at the school newspaper as a copy editor. And she was an incredibly meticulous copy editor. And she's currently a professional editor who lives in Brooklyn, New York. And this is her profession. This is her career. But when she got that job at the Daily Iowan, I mean, Lisa was like, oh, there's a big fish. I want that job too. And so she applied to be a copy editor. And she was also a copy editor. Well, that year at the Daily Iowan, they won an award for excellence in copy editing. And they told the crew, and they're like, yay, we got this award. But what not everybody knew was that there was an awards ceremony in Des Moines. And Lisa knew, but did not tell Kathy. And I can tell you right now, the reason they won is because Kathy is just meticulous at copy editing. But Lisa was the one who went up on that stage and accepted that award. I don't need to know this person. How do I get out of this living situation? Well, the annual lease renewal came up. And Leecha says to me, oh, we should re-sign our lease. And I said, you know what? I don't know. I really want to try living on my own just to see what that's like. And she said, oh, yeah, that sounds amazing. I want to try living on my own, too. And so she ran out and found an apartment and signed that lease and got ready to move. And I said, well, I don't actually have to move now. So I contacted my landlord, found another roommate, re-signed the lease. Sayonara. Thank you.
Christine Mounts. Recorded live at the Authentic Voice Storytelling Concert. That concert had support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. You are tuned to Stay Human on KAXE KBXE, people-powered radio, telling the stories of northern Minnesota. We're streaming at KAXE.org 24 hours a day because of the generous support of our listeners who know a good thing when they hear it. Please join us if you're not already a member with a donation at that website, or text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Still to come in this hour, Bernadine Jocelyn is a witness to history, and Corey Kologi takes a walk among the tombstones. First, here's a song from the Ukrainian band Daka Braka.
Oh,
Up next, this story from Bernadine Jocelyn.
When the news reached us on Christmas Eve in 1979 that the Soviets had invaded Afghanistan, my younger brother Mark and I were sipping ouzo, sitting at one of those round, you know, aluminum cafe tables outside of Christo's Bar in Nafplion, a little resort town in the Peloponnese in Greece. And we had rolled up into Nafplion because after 5 or 6 months bumming around Europe, we'd heard through the Magic Bus network that there was work to be had picking oranges in the Peloponnese. And so we'd rolled into town, and there we were among with a couple other dozen European, scruffy, hippie wannabe travelers picking oranges. And word rolls through town that the Soviets had invaded Afghanistan. Could that really be true? And how were we going to find out if it was true or not? None of us spoke Greek well enough. There was no English language media. It was a long time before the internet was even the dream in anybody's heart. So we decided that it made sense to figure it out, look into this a little more deeply, because we were feeling kind of close to Afghanistan being there in Greece. So we decided to pull our money together, and one of us agreed to take the bus back to Athens, and 36 hours later came back with a newspaper, the International Herald Review, and sure enough, there was the headline, Soviets had invaded Afghanistan. And this news evoked in me an image of a nuclear mushroom cloud. I was afraid that the United States was going to somehow feel big in its britches and feel like we had to like go after the Soviets or do something about that. And that could be the slippery slope. I was a child of the 60s. Maybe some of the rest of you remember those duck and hide drills we used to do in school. Remember that Bert the Turtle guy? And he'd like duck into his shell to protect himself from a nuclear holocaust. Somehow it wasn't very persuasive. So the orange picking season ended. Our money ran out. We come back home to the United States, and I'm thinking, if I'm serious about this saving the world from a nuclear holocaust thing, what should I do? And I realized that, you know, one step I could take that might help is I could get a credential so I could like know what I was talking about. So I enrolled in a fancy graduate program. I'm studying arms control. We're studying circular error probabilities, throw weights. I'm studying the nuclear strategy of the day, which was called Mutually Assured Destruction. The acronym they used for that was MAD, M-A-D. I thought that was a ironically appropriate acronym for nuclear war theory. But I also realized that if I was going to really be good at saving the world from nuclear holocaust, that I should learn something about our erstwhile opponents, the Soviets. And so I started studying things Russian, Russian language, Russian history, Russian literature. Oh my gosh, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Turgenev, it was amazing. I had the world's best Russian teacher, and he taught us to love our mistakes. He said it didn't matter if we made mistakes because people were just trying to communicate with them. And to illustrate that point, he taught us this wonderful Russian aphorism by Alexander Pushkin. Maybe some of you have heard of him. He was introduced to me as the father of modern literary Russian. So he has this beautiful little quip that goes like this. See if you can hear the rhyme in it. Как уст румяный без улыбки, без грамматической ошибки, я русскую речь не люблю. And what that means is, just as I cannot appreciate the ruby lips of a maiden without a smile upon it, so can I not appreciate the beauty of a Russian language without grammatical errors. And so with the love of Russian culture in my heart and those hard credentials of arms control under my belt and my credential, in 1987, I then find myself on the what we called the Soviet desk, the Office of Soviet Union Affairs and the Bureau of European Affairs in the U.S. Department of State. I'd gotten a job working for the State Department when Mikhail Gorbachev is coming to Washington to sign the Intermediate Nuclear Force Treaty, the INF Treaty. And in that office, I was definitely the low person on the totem pole. I was the junior officer, and I happened to speak Russian, which is helpful. So I got given all the grunt work to do, to like help get this big state visit off the ground. We've just seen as a nation what it means to have an official state visit when our President Trump was in received by the King of England, and they drove him around in a open carriage around Windsor Castle. So our equivalent was receiving Mikhail Gorbachev. Remember now, he was here in his capacity as the General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. And in those, in according to official state protocol, when you're welcoming the head of state, the nation's capital is festooned in the flag of the guest. And so remember the red hammer and sickle banner of the Soviet Union, the red banner with the yellow hammer for the worker and the yellow sickle for the farmers, and all up and down Pennsylvania Avenue and Constitution Avenue draped in the hammer and sickle banners, and the White House as well. We at the State Department joked it looks like the Soviets had conquered us with the charm offensive. The next morning, the next day was the signing of the INF Treaty in the East Room of the White House. And that evening, I had wiled myself a seat, an invitation to the crown jewel cultural event of this exchange. Van Cliborne was going to play a piano concerto in the East Ballroom, where earlier that day the treaty had been signed. Now, for the average American, that means seemed like an odd choice. Maybe none of you here tonight have heard of Van Cliborne, but he was the equivalent of a rock star in Soviet Union, because in 1958, at the first Tchaikovsky competition, he had been awarded first prize. This then 23-year-old Texan, recent graduate from that famous school in Boston, Juilliard, 23-year-old Texan, they awarded, he played some version of Tchaikovsky's first piano concerto that aroused emotions in this very discerning audience of Muscovites that they had never felt before, and delivered him an 8-minute standing ovation. And when the judges were confronted with this, you know, the whole purpose of hosting this Tchaikovsky festival was to showcase Soviet superior educational system and their fantastic, you know, supremacy in cultural matters. And so when this American young guy got this, it was just very disconcerting. And the judges, so the story went to check with Khrushchev, who was then the general secretary in the audience, what should we do? Can we really award this young American this award? And purportedly Khrushchev said, if he played the best, give him the award. So 23 years later, here we are in the East Room of the White House. Van Cliborne is playing the same piano concerto to the new Soviet leader, Gorbachev, sitting in the East Room. It was very moving. I could see that Gorbachev and Raisa were moved. But as the evening was about to wind down, Van Cliborne, unscripted and unexpectedly, turns to Gorbachev, and he addresses him directly and says, I want to thank you for making this moment of peace possible. And as a personal gesture of my affection for you, I'm going to now play a beloved popular song. Some of you in the audience may know this song. It's called Moscow Nights. Yes? It goes something like this. Если бы знали вы, как мне дороги подмосковные вечера. Если знали вы, как мне дороги подмосковные вечера. And the words mean, if I could only share with you, if I could only make you understand how dear to me are these Moscow nights. And I felt in that moment the unraveling of that knot of fear that I had been carrying since Nafplion. Peace was breaking out all over. The Soviets were in the White House. All was well. Thank you.
Thanks to Bernadine Jocelyn. I hope we'll hear more of her international adventures on future editions of Stay Human. Here is Van Cliburn, of course, with a sampling from Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto No. 1. One more story today from our live concert of The Authentic Voice, this from Iron Range storyteller Corey Kaloji.
Well, I'm not very good with directions. The best I can usually do is, well, sorry, but I'm not from around here. I'm a pack sacker. Now, many of you are thinking, well, we knew you were a pack sacker already. But what you're really thinking is you knew I was a backpacker. And they're not the same thing at all. To give you some idea what I'm talking about, in the little string of towns that stretches across the Iron Range from Ely, almost all the way to Grand Rapids, there's a little town of Chisholm. And people in all these towns, but in Chisholm in particular, they'll tell you that in order to be from around here, you either have to be buried here or born here. And in fact, being buried there is really not good enough. For instance, you could be buried in Chisholm, but your gravestone might be the only one that bears your family's name. It's also true that you can live in one of these places for a long time, as I have, almost half a century, or be married, or I guess in my case, I should say, and be married to a local person for almost half a century, and it's still not good enough to make you a local. You're still a pack sacker. Now, you may wonder what a pack sacker is. Exactly. It's not really a good thing. The pack sackers were people that came up to the Iron Range in the 1970s during the taconite plant construction boom. And they were, I guess it wouldn't necessarily say that they were unsavory, but they were not exactly reliable. And it didn't help that quite often they would marry a local gal, and then when the construction was over, they'd cart her away to some distant place like, I don't know, Grand Rapids. And to make matters worse, they might make a local gal pregnant and then disappear themselves at the end of the construction boom and leave her behind. Now, my future father-in-law referred to me as a pack sacker, but it wasn't right away. At first, when I was just kind of around, when I was a guest or a visitor, I was okay. When I was in his yard and at his table outfitting for a canoe trip down the Mississippi River, well, I was just fine. I wasn't a pack sacker yet because, well, I didn't have any intentions of staying any time at all, as far as he do. And so I was all right. It didn't help that I left my foreign car behind while I was gone in his yard, and that one of his sons messing around in the car broke something, so that Lambert, my future father-in-law, felt obligated to fix this thing by chiseling a hole through the floor of my beloved Carmen Ghia. Yep. He was overheard to say at the time, "No wonder the Krauts lost the war." So everything was fine until a year and a half later when I came back engaged to his daughter, Doris, who is here right now. And that would have been so bad, except shortly after announcing our engagement, we also explained that I was no longer going to be known as Corden Thomas Godfrey III, but instead I would be just plain Corey Kaloji. That was Lambert's last name, and also Doris's. Now, this was unheard of at the time, and is fairly unheard of right now also. And what he said was, and he thought it was quite bizarre, what he said was, how could this be possible? How could a man take a woman's name? Is he running from the law? Did he kill a man? He's reported to have really said these things. And actually, I hadn't done either of those things. So anyway, I went on to get a teaching job in Chisholm in a school where Lambert had attended, and also where my future wife Doris had attended school. Actually, by then, she was actually my wife. And my students still called me a pack sacker there. And this was a long time ago. I taught there for almost 40 years. There was an old guy there. He was old already at the time, named Jerry Nevinen. And he could tell you the genealogy going back several generations of every person in the town of Chisholm. Now, this was true until it wasn't true anymore. And he started noticing names that he couldn't connect to anybody he knew until maybe he interviewed the kid and found out where they were connected. It turned out that being a packsacker was not having the meeting or the weight did not carry along as it used to be. And the only real solid list of the people that were local was chiseled onto the gravestones at the cemetery. Now, I like to visit cemeteries. It's not what it sounds like. It's really not that morbid. I would go in the springtime when the school band played at Memorial Day. And afterwards, I'd like to traipse around the cemetery. And I very much enjoyed seeing the names of my students on the names of my students' families on the headstones. Sometimes, again, going back generations, and I could find my own family's headstones too, generations of Kalogis. And it occurred to me, if I were to die and be buried here, people would think that I was a local. I would finally have achieved the status of a local citizen of Chisholm, Minnesota. Now, I also noticed at about this time that I was recognizing students whose names I had never found in the cemetery. Things were changing. Genealogy was getting a lot more complicated. One year, I had 5 Ashleys in one grade, and 2 of them were sisters. Yeah, things were not as they used to be. And so I wondered to myself at some point, how it was in this town of immigrants, in a nation of immigrants, that we cared so much about citizenship. You know, that it was such a big deal to be a packsacker when it seemed clear that the entire species was migratory, and not migratory like most species that just get together in huge, you know, groups and move all together at one time just across the Serengeti or some such place, is there and back again. Instead, we were a species that were continuously migrating ever since Adam and Eve first came down from the trees and headed off across Africa and spread out to every corner of the world. We've been on the move. The most poignant part, the most resonant part of the story of the Garden of Eden is when Adam and Eve emigrate from this apparently like perfect place to live, just to go somewhere different. So it seems that we are all packsackers, all migrants all the time. And we have, like, as much as we have this inborn compulsion to move to a new place, at the same time, we seem to be just driven to stay once we got somewhere and to put up a foundation and put a wall up around that and make a flag and wave it around and swear that we are going to defend that flag to the death until we move again. So we're always on the move. We're all packsackers. We're all just passing through, and really, we're all just a little bit unreliable. Thank you.
Thanks to Corey Kalogi and to Bernadine Jocelyn, Christine Mounts, Scott Stoll, and Susie Sachs-Hogleffler for telling their stories today on Stay Human. I'm Michael Goldberg. I hope you can catch us again this time next week for another hour of spirit and courage in story and song.
There comes a time when we all got to speak as one. No more one man stand and shout at another one. Oh, no, 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 no. Impress yourself with your tolerance.
And practice for the day. You know the day is coming.
nothing time.